So first of all, we usually do like a Namo Tassa to start this. I didn't do that last time, so we start with Namo Tassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhasa. If we can scroll to page 8. See if we can get to page 8, 5 components of existence. And while you're doing that, yesterday I was trying to find where on that little dongle we had the foreword to the 5 components of existence, forward to the word of the Buddha. So I have the foreword here, and instead of just trying to email it or carry it over, it's on little pieces of paper if anybody wishes to take the foreword for the word of the Buddha, but it explains what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. So here we go. I'll just read it out while you're finding the 5 components of existence, the Kanda. Have you got that now? Okay, but first of all, the word of the Buddha foreword. In 1907, it's a long time ago, not 2007, 1907, the pioneering German-born monk Venerable Jnana Tiloka published the English version of The Word of the Buddha. It is described as an outline of the teachings of the Buddha in the words of the Pali Canon. It consists of a selection of authentic teachings from the suttas that expound on the core Buddhist Dharma of the Four Noble Truths, including the Noble Eightfold Path. For almost 20 years, I had been using the Word of the Buddha as a textbook to introduce my monastic students to the Buddhist suttas. Indeed, every Anagarika, that's a postulant, and Samanera, novice monk, must complete this course in basic Buddhist teaching before they are allowed to receive the higher ordination as a bhikkhu. I have taken such steps to establish quality control in the monks under my training, so at the very least, they are made aware of what the Buddha really taught from the most reliable source, the sutta. Unfortunately, there is a problem. Although the Dharma is timeless, the usual presentation has become as if overgrown by impenetrable thickets of tradition. I have received countless well-intended criticisms, that all the repetitions are discouraging. The similes are so archaic as to be obtuse, that means you can't see them, and some revered renderings of key Buddhist terms are rusted shut, so you can't get into them and understand them. The book, The Exegesis, is well past its use-by date. And so I redid a very ancient saying, rather turn on the electric light than complain about darkness. Now you may know that I've used that simile many times, rather light a candle than complain about the darkness. But who lights a candle these days? You turn on the electric light. So this is an ancient Chinese saying, updated. This little book, then, my translation, is not another translation. It is a new type of translation. Not so much for detached scholars, but for those who immerse their whole lives in these teachings. I have followed Professor A.K. Warder's insightful advice that, this quote, it is the sentences which are the natural units of discourse and which are the minimum units having precise, fully articulated meaning. For purposes of study, we have to assign approximate meanings to words and list these in vocabularies. But these generalized meanings of words are extremely vague, whereas sentences have exact meanings. In translation, one may find close equivalents to sentences, while it is often impossible to give close equivalents for words. Thus, in order to convey the meaning, I have chosen to translate sentence for sentence and not word for word. A word has no permanent essence outside of a sentence. My authority to translate rests on my reputation as a well-known Buddhist meditation teacher, trained to think in Cambridge University, and then trained to be silent for 9 years under Ajahn Chah. Author of many books on meditation, teacher of Pali to many monks, and 44 years now, immersed in the life of a renunciant, open to scrutiny. To be able to see that you walk your talk. For example, for many years, this is an example. For many years, I have consistently protested against the traditional translation of concentration for the Pali word samadhi, instead preferring stillness. This is not a trivial point for debate amongst philologists, people who study language, because this point cuts to the very heart of the Buddhist path to freedom. Nor is my protest to serve an ego, quite the opposite. The practice of concentration and the willpower on which it depends actually reinforces the ego. Contrary, stillness and the letting go, renunciation on which it depends, brings the ego to cessation. And this is what we're seeing here. This is not the final version. Translations will always be work in progress. I only hope that this version will elucidate, inspire, and challenge. Students have remarked on listening to classes before on earlier drafts of this book that it is like listening to the teachings and the suttas for the first time, and their power is frightening and at the same time compelling. As for improvements, I welcome better sentence by sentence. I welcome better sentence by sentence translations, but only when they arise from someone immersed in these teachings, living as a renunciant for the cessation of all ego or any concept of a permanent essence within or beyond the five khandhas. And lastly, the quote, Sabbe Dhamma Nalang Abhinavesana. There is nothing worth keeping. So that was just the introduction, which I thought was actually on there, but I had to get it from the computer over in Bodhinyan. But anyone wants a copy of that, most welcome to take one afterwards. But last night we were talking about a question about the five components of existence, what's usually called the five khandhas, and five groups. To me, that doesn't, or five aggregates. Groups, aggregates of what? This is what is supposed to make up this thing we call a human being with body and mind. And that somebody was asking about how the idea of the aggregates affected by clinging and the five aggregates, are they different? And people spend a lot of time on these points, and they do have a consequence. If you get it, misunderstand this, you start to believe, oh, the five aggregates aren't the problem. It's the clinging to it. So you can have a five aggregates without clinging, and that is when a person becomes totally enlightened, no problem, but they've still got the five aggregates, which is a lot of what we call gomayang. If you haven't heard that word before, gomayang, go means a male cow, a bull. Mayang means the stuff which comes off out of the backside of the bull. S-H-I-T. I'd only say this word once in this retreat. Bullshit. People get upset when I say such words, so now I just call it gomayang. So here is, the trouble comes when we look at even just one word, upadana. And as I mentioned yesterday, that literally means fueling, taking up the electricity which takes up the inspiration which keeps you coming here. You take up that inspiration. That fuels practice. The air, the oxygen fuels your process of metabolism. All this stuff is the fuel which keeps you going. It's an upadana. It's not a clinging. There's other words for that. This is upadana. This is taking up. And when you get that idea, here we go, another little one. This I attribute to Bhikkhu Bodhi. The word Dhamma. Okay, we use that for so much things, but what actually is the Dhamma? And he explained it in this little essay. It's like root meaning. What is the Dhamma? How is it used? And the Dhamma is just the cause. It's looking at what we're experiencing now, any phenomena, and it's the why. Where does this come from? Tracing it back to its source. It's like its origin. Why? That's looking at this, whatever this happens to be, and seeing its cause, the Dhamma. It's almost, you know, similar to like the basic rules of science. The why, the Dhamma of you know, why things are in this physical world, but extending it to the mental world, the world of the mind. That's the Dhamma. And the consequence of that, from here and seeing where this is going to lead to, the atta, that's the benefit, the consequence, where it's going to go to. But that is wonderful. What is the Dhamma? It is the why. And the consequence is the where to. Anyway, for here, this particular passage, what are the five components of existence that are suffering? They are as follows. The body, rupee, can't improve upon that. At least I've never found a better translation for that. Rupa, in this context, it does have a different meaning in other contexts. And the vedana, people always call that feeling. Pleasant, unpleasant, or somewhere in between. Yeah, that doesn't cut it either for me. Because what it really means is just what we know in English as experience. Now, this sensory experience for the five senses and also the sixth sense as well. Yes, it has three different types. Just like, you know, there are different races in this world. There are different genders. There are different ages. But that qualification is just one way of dealing with this thing we call humanity. And here, this is just one way of dealing with this thing called experience. Just classifying it in three major types, pleasant, unpleasant, or somewhere in between. And of course, now somewhere in between, how in between do you have to be? Because if you're in between, there is no real, you know, neutral experience. It's either a tiny bit pleasant or a tiny bit unpleasant. So this is one of the reasons it's just describing the thing called experience. And you got perception, brilliant translation. It's actually the only translation. And will, the sankhara, as I was saying yesterday, that's very important to get that. And the last one, vijnana, sometimes they call it consciousness, which is also misleading. Consciousnesses, six completely different types of consciousness. And when you start to put the plural in, which one is the real consciousness? None of them are. They come and go, they swap, they change around. Now, saying things like that, and of course, people say, well, but you can define it, you can get in there into the definitions. There are always six classes of consciousness, says the Buddha. They don't really overlap. You've got one or the other ones, aren't there? So, consciousnesses. So, it is radical. It's not the usual way of translating, but I will stick to my guns. That's not a wrong metaphor. But I'll be stubborn. I can argue as well as anybody.
And of course, I've got the reins as a monk to actually to have some experience, know what I'm talking about. So, and this, you know, was from the Mahavedala Sutta. Is that fuel, upadana, this is a question asked yesterday, the same as these five components of existence, or is the fuel something apart from those five components of existence? Now, what they were asking yesterday, the five aggregates and the five aggregates affected by clinging. And that was the translation, but I am now just being a bit more careful. The fuel, the same as those five components of existence, or is the fuel something apart from the five components of existence? That fuel is neither the same as the five components of existence, nor is the fuel separate from the five components of existence. It is the desire and wanting that is part of these five components of existence that is the fuel that sustains them. Inside the five components of existence right now, there is the fuel, there is the wanting, there is the craving, that is the fuel which keeps this process going. Where does that wanting really lie? Mostly in the sankhara, but also the experience as well, wanting to experience and perceive. All of that is actually in this process called the five components of existence. Anyway, that just because it says it down here, you can see very quickly, any kind of body, whatever, past, future or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, that's the body, component of existence. All bodies should be seen as they really are. With correct wisdom, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not a permanent essence. Any kind of experience, any kind of perception, any kind of will, and any other mental formations, any kind of consciousness, whatever, past, future or present, one's own or others, gross or subtle, inferior, superior, far or near, that's called the consciousnesses, component of existence. They're all included in these five components of existence. Not leaving anything outside. That is an important point. For those who listen to those teachings for a lot, the human being always wants to find some little crack, some little loophole. They work so hard to become enlightened. Surely they could enjoy it forever and ever. We call that the Walt Disney illusion. You meet Prince Charming or Cinderella, whatever it is, where you live happily ever after, the ultimate retirement home of the soul. Unfortunately, that's not how it works. Anyway, let's go down now. I said I was going to go do some Satipatthana. So, you got the Satipatthana? That's somewhere around there. What have we got? Oh, I've gone too far. Here we go. Oh. I've gone a long way further. I'm far ahead. I was just wondering whether to do the Anapanasati. Let's do the Anapanasati, because that's also Satipatthana. Oh, no, I did promise, so I'll keep my promises. Right mindfulness. That is on page 40. You got page 40? Yeah. Close enough. We there? Close. Right mindfulness. Number 7. 7 is a lucky number in Korea. No, a bit more. Well, my mind's 40. Keep on going. Right mindfulness. Number 7. You got it? Yay. Okay, what now is right mindfulness? The four focuses of mindfulness. I haven't been able to do better than mindfulness. Mindfulness is a great translation. The four focuses, what I call focuses, satipatthana, is where you focus your mindfulness, where you place it. The four focuses of mindfulness lead in one direction only. And I always say, lead in one direction only. That's Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. And for those, I can only call them scallywags, who say it's the only way that is unsustainable, that is not what the Pali means, there's no way you can call ekayana. It was ekayana, fine, but it's ekayana. You've got to be very careful with the grammar and with the basically just how the things work together, because these are just little stuff which just do not agree with the Pali. Leading one direction only to the purification of beings, to going beyond sadness and crying, to the disappearance of physical and mental suffering, to attainment of the true way, to the realization of Nibbana. What are the four focuses of mindfulness? And again, 1, 2, 3, 4. Enumerate them for your convenience. And they all start with the same beginning. Having restrained the five hindrances, you abide aware of the body, energized, knowing the purpose of what you are doing, and mindful. Having restrained the five hindrances, you are aware of experience. 3, you're aware of the mind. 4, you're aware of mind objects. Energized, knowing the purpose of what you're doing, and mindful. And of course, the first part of that, which you might be a little surprised at, is having restrained the five hindrances as the, what's it called? The thing you have to get first of all, before you even do the satipatthana, to having restrained the five hindrances. Why do I say that? Where does that come from? There is the phrase in Pali, vinaya loke abhija domanasang, which good old Professor Rice Davids, 100 years ago, translated it as having abandoned grief and covetousness for the world. And that's how I read it. And even at the time, as only a young student of meditation, a young monk, I thought, what the heck does that mean? But in those days, I was just too respectful to challenge it. What does it mean, having abandoned grief and covetousness for the world? And then when you started to learn Pali, you started to see that vinaya means having restraint. Same as like vinaya, restraint, the discipline. You could say having discipline the five hindrances, fine. But I call it more like restrained is a bit better. Because discipline sometimes has a bad meaning if you've been to school. So we have, why the five hindrances? Loke abhija. And so when I was reading through mostly the Anguttara Nikaya in Pali, you're reading, hey, this is loke abhija, where usually you would find kamachanda. Kamachanda was the usual word for the first of the five hindrances. And there in its place was loke abhija. It was what we call a synonym, an alternative word for the same thing. So this was a lot of times, not just once or twice, many times they'd used what is usually translated as having abandoned covetousness for the world. That was a synonym, an alternative for the first hindrance. And the second hindrance is usually, kamachanda, it's aversion, usually they call it, but in this one they called it domanasa. And domanasa was also used as an alternative for the second hindrance. So you see, these two are alternatives in the satipatthana for the first and second hindrance, or the five hindrances. And so then you looked in the commentaries. And those commentaries, I sometimes say, oh, the commentaries, you know, they're not very accurate. But there, those commentaries make an important point. And those commentaries say that in these two suttas, the Mahasatipatthana Sutta, that's in the Digha Nikaya, and in the Satipatthana Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya, the two main Satipatthana Suttas, that is what these words mean. The first two hindrances. And they say it was just a way of speaking in Pali when you mention the first two of a group. You're supposed to include the whole of the group. It's just like a shorthand. And so even in those two commentaries, they actually explain and authenticate the point that the what is usually translated as having abandoned grief and covetousness for the world, it is to be understood as having restrained the five hindrances. That is what one needs before one does Satipatthana. Now, if I was reading the whole of the word of the Buddha, you might have made that point already. Because the restraining of the five hindrances is also what one is doing through the first six factors of the Eightfold Path. In particular, what is usually called right effort. Sometimes I call it right endeavor. I'm really thinking of changing that to right restraint. Because that's really what it's doing. What goes before that is your precepts. Speech, action, livelihood. This is how you restrain and you restrain the senses. You keep a simple life. You're actually just restraining the hindrances. So this is actually the part of the first part of the Eightfold Path. You restrain the hindrances. Because those hindrances are what stop you being mindful. How can you be mindful when you sort of want something, you have greed, you have lust, you have ill will? That's a sign that your mind is being perverted. You're not seeing what's there. You see what you want to see. You're not sort of seeing what's there. You're just in denial of something which is really nasty for you. Restless. How can you be mindful when you're restless? You're all over the place. Sloth and torpor. So dull, you're not really mindful at all. And lastly, the doubt. And of course, the simile for doubt, which you've heard me say. I said, this is word of the Buddha, but people say, you taught that last year, this is more word of Ajahn Brahm than word of the Buddha, the way it goes on. But the doubt, that simile of being lost in the mountains when I was a young man. Up in Scotland alone, lost in the mountains, in the mist, and I came really close, no exaggeration, to not being here. Just came to the edge of a cliff. There weren't that many sort of, you know, such dangerous cliffs in that part of the Northwest Highlands. And because it was so misty, I couldn't see the end of my hand. And I got scared. It was dangerous. Like, you know, one step and I would have, you know, fallen down the cliff and be dead. So I thought, using science, water flows downhill. So I found a little creek, followed the creek, and then whichever way it went, I was going to follow that creek. Left, right, I didn't care, I was going to follow that creek. We joined another little creek, which made a bigger creek, and then to a stream. It was always leading me downhill, and I followed that. At least I wouldn't be going around in circles. So down and down and down and down and down I went, until you came underneath the mist, and I could see where I was. To me, that was a wonderful simile of how to escape from doubt. Well, you can't see where you're going. In this particular case, follow peace, happiness, tranquility. That's why, in reasons I have these peaceometers and still on me. You know it's going in the right direction. You feel more peaceful. You don't know where it's going to lead, but keep on going until the mind gets so peaceful you can see really clearly. You're beyond those five hindrances, especially the hindrance of doubt. So this is important to overcome this, first of all. The five hindrances. And then you abide aware of these four focuses, the body, experience, the mind and mind objects, and mindful, so energized. Part of overcoming the five hindrances, you get energized. And some of you have had those experiences before, you're meditating, you really get inspired, or really peaceful, and you're full of energy. Sometimes you can't sleep at night. Don't need to, you can catch up at sleep when you listen to one of my talks. But in the meantime, yeah, just use the energy. It is bright because you really have got some nice meditation going. Wow. And you need that. That's a sign the five hindrances are really weakened. And knowing the purpose of what you're doing. What are you doing this for? That's when you are doing any... Why are you meditating? Is it to become just... again, as I said, I think this morning or yesterday, to beat your personal best. To improve. Well, you know, maybe last time your mother was here and she got first jhana and said, yeah, I can do better than that. You're not doing this, you know, just out of ego or pride. You're doing this to be free, to be peaceful, to be liberated. It's not another achievement. In Singapore, just how many degrees and certificates have you got? Do you want another one? Shall I give you a certificate? Stream winner, wise returner, non-returner. As I said the other night, if I don't remember who you are, you gave me non-returner last time, you demoted me, Ajahn Brahm. So, you abide of these things, energized, knowing the person, what you're doing, and mindful. So anyway, that's the beginning of all these practices of Satipatthana. It leads on from where one has been in the first six factors and it leads forward later on to the jhanas. So, first of all, any questions on that? Any feedback? You know, I know you're really not supposed to question teachers, you know, in the Chinese tradition, but this is not mainland China. You won't be disappeared. If you argue with me. Okay. So anyway, we'll just go forward. I'll get the questions in the evening because they're anonymous in the evening. You write them on pieces of paper and you think they're anonymous? Yeah.
Maybe you could just say something about knowing the purpose of what you're doing because that's quite a key point.
Yeah, this is called Sampajanya. And Sampajanya, it means with wisdom. Now, Pajanya, part of it, please excuse me for going into the grammar of Pali, but Pajanya is just the same as Panya. You know, just when we have language, we always tend to abbreviate things. So I remember 100 years ago in London, you would go from one place to another in an omnibus. An omnibus was a big carriage for everybody, which is what omnibus means. It's a Latin word. And of course, saying I'm going to catch the omnibus today was just too much time. So they shortened it to bus. So if you go to get a bus to the airport, with a bus driver, you should actually be a bit more specific and say, I'm taking the omnibus today to the airport. Where is omnibus number 10? And what is the omnibus driver like today? So we just shorten words. And it's the same with Sampajanya becomes Panya, with Panya, with wisdom. And that's actually, remember Ajahn Chah, he'd always never use Sati Sampajanya, he'd always use Sati Panya. Which is actually how it was described in the commentaries, already shortened by then. So it's the purpose of what you're doing. What are you doing this for? Why are you being mindful of your body? You're not a doctor, you're not an anatomist, you're not trying to sort of find some secret of how bodies can live forever. What are you doing? You're understanding your body. You're stuck with this body for life. It's a life sentence, having a body. So,
What is it like? You're getting to understand it and know it. And that's one of the reasons I was saying so far, just it's amazing what you can do with your own body by being aware of it. And how you can actually improve its health. And when I was in the DMZ, this was 8 days ago, you know, that I didn't know, sometimes I should really ask what they asked me to do, but I just do it and see what happens. Live in the present moment. But then when I found you've got to do a 6.5 kilometre walk in the DMZ, and it was just, that was only just actually inside, let alone getting there and getting back again. And I never walked that far for years. No other monk would do that. Ajahn Ganhar, no way. And all these other monks, they disappeared. I was the only sort of senior monk there who was doing this. So anyway, but they kept asking, can you do this? Yeah, why not? Always that positive attitude. You can do anything, you know, if you've got the right mind. So, you know, after about the first kilometre, you started getting a bit tired. So what do? Present moment, and walk faster, not slower. And I thought, this is really interesting, because usually the tendency is when you're tired is to slow down. No, speed up. And you've got all this energy. That's really good. So I had a wonderful time doing that. And so that was a really good time. Just a nice exercise. And I survived, no problem. And you know, not really supposed to survive. But anyway, you did. So anyway, that's what you're doing it for. You get to understand the body. And sometimes challenge it. Also, when you're on a retreat here, sometimes I teach this to the monks and the nuns, sometimes you're tired. You've done a long day, a lot of work, and you go back to your room, oh, I'm exhausted. Okay, I'm going to meditate now. You can't meditate, you need a rest. And sometimes I challenge my body. I say, no, I'm going to meditate now. And you get these incredible meditations where you're not supposed to. Just a bit rebellious. Don't believe my body. And sometimes you challenge it that way and it's amazing. Sometimes the mind is so powerful. So anyway, that's aware of what you're doing. You've got to look after your body though. So you're by aware of the body. Knowing the person, what you're doing, why you have a body, and what it's here for. And experience, getting to understand experience. You know, what actually is it? And why little things such as, do you like happiness? You can't have happiness without suffering. The two go together. Because you will find that, oh, you know that if ever you do study some history. If you ever go to some of these old palaces where these incredibly royal, say, Maharajas used to live, and they were so cold, and their beds, their mattresses were just so hard, and their food was so dirty, but it was the best you could get then. And these days, look at what, even in Jhana Grove, for what was it, I don't know, $30 a night or $40 a night, I don't know what you pay for this. Beautiful mattresses, hot water, great food. Wow, a Maharaja would just die to be in a room like that. I mean, really die, but just, wow, this is so pleasurable. And entertainment, you get, if you're, you know, keeping your precepts, you get all these incredible jokes from Ajahn Brahm. The court jester. But if you don't get jokes, what happens is you can turn on one of these things and you get whatever you want. Music, videos, entertainment. You live just like royalty. But, because everyone else lives like this, we don't notice it. So, pleasures, whatever pleasure you have, the only reason you appreciate it is when it disappears. That becomes suffering. The space, the pause between two pleasant moments. And when the pleasure disappears or just gets a little bit less, that is called pain.
suffering. You can't have one without the other. If you may have the best chef in the world, 5-star Michelin chef, then one day he doesn't sort of makes a tiny mistake and it's only 4-star standard. And then people just complain. To me, 4-star standard will be just out of this world. So, sometimes, having been in Thailand for 7 years, when I went to go and visit my mother, I mentioned this story a few days ago, I got the cheapest ticket on the cheapest airline I could possibly get. And it was on, I think, Philippine Airlines. And economy class, really cramped. And when I got in there and sat down, I couldn't believe how luxurious it was. It was a padded seat. I hadn't sat on a padded seat for 7 years. I was really thin. I didn't have my own padding like I have today. I was really skin and bones. Number two, there was no mosquitoes. They didn't allow mosquitoes to fly in the aircraft. And I thought, wow, where's the mosquitoes? You get used to them. You kind of miss them in a weird way. And they served hot food. On the menu, there was no sort of sticky rice and frogs. It was actually, you know, decent food. And people were complaining how cramped it was and how slow it was and how the food was disgusting. I said, what are you talking about? This is amazing food and amazing soft. And even actually gave me some ice cream. I didn't need ice cream for that for 7 years. So you can see that pleasure is measured by what went before, the amount of suffering you had before. And suffering, the intensity of it, is from the pleasure which went before, which you've now lost. You can't have one without the other. So that's what you understand about experience. Once you get that, it's just, if you're having a good time, great, it's not going to last. If you're having a painful time, don't worry, I can't last either. You're going to get pleasure coming next. The two work together. So you understand this, so you don't get stuck in these things. And the mind, already, you know, with experience, also you understand how experience works. That's why that you look at your body, how peaceful is it, how relaxed is it. You let it go, it gets much more relaxed. And the mind, the peaceometer. How peaceful are you? When we get to this, we can actually see it in more detail later on. What causes these defilements to come up into the mind, which agitates you? What causes them to dissipate, to disappear? You're looking at your peaceometer. Because I just, instead of saying just the third Satipatthana, give it an English name or a modern name, peaceometer. How peaceful are you? Right now. What makes you more peaceful? There you're listening to the Dhamma and you're understanding how to get more peaceful, which is worth much more than all the talks which I give. Anyway, so we do the mindfulness of the body and it starts off with mindfulness of breathing. Yeah, it's a difficult one, but I'm going to put that aside until we actually get there, mind objects. The original of the mind objects was only two types of mind objects, because, you know, there are different versions of the Satipatthana found in different places, and usually the simplest is the earliest. It's just a rule of thumb. People tend to add things rather than take things off, especially in suttas, in holy texts. They don't like, sort of, they feel it's, they can't sort of take away what the Buddha said, but they can also add something else, you know, which from another place which he said. So the earliest version of the Satipatthana shows only two mind objects in the 4 Satipatthana. And it's interesting to contemplate why they're there, and it gives an idea of what mind objects really are.
Because the two were the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors. Those two, nothing else. The other two, the other part of the four satipatthana seems to have come in much later. Additions. They're not wrong, but why was it the original version only had those two? Five hindrances and seven enlightenment factors. Because basically, the five hindrances, they are the problem. And when those five hindrances are abandoned, overcome, first of all, you restrain them enough. This is restrained, first of all, not abandoned, first of all, to do satipatthana. And then afterwards, they're abandoned. And when they're abandoned, then the seven enlightenment factors just come up. It's the hindrances, they're stopping the enlightenment factors, they're stopping wisdom, they're stopping peace. So once those five hindrances, the cause, the pathogens, are seen and eliminated, then the enlightenment happens. So it's just the cause and the antidote. So I don't know, mind objects, it's dhammas. It's called, you know, the Dhamma, which is the cause. So, I don't know, maybe I've just, instead of four satipatthanas, mindfulness of causes. Not really, it doesn't really work, but of the enemies and the solutions, whatever. Sometimes it could be just the five terrorists and the seventh cavalry, because it's seven enlightenment factors. Good. In the old Western movies, it was the Seventh Cavalry. I don't know where they got from. Would actually come and rescue John Wayne and his mates from sort of the whatever's happening. And this is my generation. I'm sorry for those people who don't understand. I'm getting old. Anyway, mindfulness of breathing. And how are you aware of the body? Number one, you go to a secluded place, sit down comfortably and give priority to establishing mindfulness. Priority to establishing mindfulness. Instead of establishing mindfulness in front of you. And that never made sense to me. In front of who? I mean, actually, what does it mean physically? Where am I? Am I down here? Am I here? Am I up in my head? What does it mean in front of you? And of course, that sort of, you know, caused me a lot of wonderment. What does that actually mean? It cannot be sort of on the tip of your nose. That's not in front of me. I don't live this side of my nose. And of course, I suffer from hay fever. It's getting on to hay fever. Anyone who's a bit sniffy at the moment, it's probably not a cold, it's a hay fever season. So you take an antihistamine or something, and that will sort of sort you out. It's not a cold, it's just the flowers coming out. So I said, I can't watch the breath at the tip of my nose. You know why? Because it was stuffed up. There was no breath coming out the tip of my nose. So I thought, oh my goodness, I can't become enlightened. I can't meditate because I'm supposed to watch the tip of my nose and there's nothing coming out the tip of my nose. And after a while you realise it's not the tip of the nose. In front of you, again, it's one of those words, it's priority. No, prior is first in your list. In front of everything else. The first thing you do, give it priority, prioritize. That's what it means, number one in the list of things to do. So, it means give priority to establishing mindfulness. First of all, don't go watching the breath when you're not peaceful enough. So you notice so far in those morning talks, I haven't even really mentioned watching the breath yet. Relaxing the body and looking at your piezometer. You know what happens? After a while, once you're relaxed, the body is nice and relaxed and the mind is pretty still, it's easy to watch the breath. In fact, you know, the breath usually comes to you. Otherwise, what happens is people say, oh, breath meditation. So off they go, they're going to watch the breath. Okay, come on, Ajahn Brahm, watch the breath. And it gets so uncomfortable that after a while, you just wander off somewhere or you fall asleep. Anything to escape. And that's why sometimes people can only watch the breath for 3 or 4 minutes. Or 3 or 4 breaths, sorry. And then they're just, it's gone. They can't watch the breath. Why? Because you didn't do the preparation.
If you're going to have a garden, then you've got to make sure the soil is okay, that it's watered, it's got enough nutrients in it, and then you plant the right seeds or right plants in it. Preparation is everything. So if you prepare the mind first of all, to establish mindfulness as a priority, be mindful first, then it's easy to watch the breath. And the problem is people rush, they go, watching the breath first of all, we've got not much time, busy. I want to be enlightened. It's really hard to come to Jhana Grove for a retreat, so I've only got 7 days, I've really got to get enlightened, no messing around, come on, watch the breath. It doesn't work that way. So, your priority is establishing mindfulness. The mindfully you breathe in, mindfully you breathe out. When the in-breath and out-breath are long, you're aware they are long. When the in-breath and out-breath are short, you're aware that they are short. Hey, hang on. What about if the in-breath and out-breath is neither long nor short, but in the middle somewhere? Then what do you do? It doesn't matter. It doesn't say you've got to do a long breath first of all. Breathe in really long. Then breathe in short. And then a long. It doesn't mean that at all. It means you just have some idea of how long your breath is, or how short your breath, or how in between it is. So it just gives you something else to make the breath a little bit more interesting. And of course, that is just one option. You don't have to do it that way. In all the meditation traditions over 2,500 years, we have like counting the breath, or we have doing a mantra like they used to do in Thailand with the breath, Buddho, Buddho, breathing in, Buddho, breathing out, Tho. As I tried, to no real success in Australia, breathing in, you say, shut, breathe out, up. Shut up. It just didn't work. So, or in Indonesia, for the Indonesians, you breathe in, mati pasti, mati pasti. What does that mean? I will die, that's for sure. Mati pasti, mati pasti. But anyway, so it just means that you understand. So what I do these days, especially in Nodamara, breathing in peace. Or if you're sick, breathing in health. If you're really miserable, breathing in happiness. If you're tired, breathing in energy. Just have an idea. But don't just say the words. What does it mean, energy? You feel what energy means, breathing in energy. Just imagine it, visualize it, and it works. And then breathing out, sort of tiredness or sickness or whatever you want to let go of. Breathing in health. Breathe out sickness. Breathing in health. Breathe out sickness. So what is actually doing there? Because your health and sickness are really important things for you, it makes the breath more interesting. And it means it's easy to watch. So that's just the first and second of the anapana, the vasana satipatthana. And then when you've got sort of enough awareness on the breath, you experience the whole of the breath as you breathe in and out. At the very beginning of an in-breath. Just see it, just when it's born. Right to the very end of an in-breath. See it just fade away. And there's a pause between the in-breath and the out-breath. Then the out-breath goes out. See it all the way to the very end. And as you breathe in, is it just all smooth, just breathe in and suddenly stop? Or is it breathe in like my breath? It breathes in and really builds up some energy and then it fades away quite quickly. It drops. And then it's a pause. As it breathes out, you can feel the air going out, reaches its peak and then suddenly drops. It breathes out and there's another pause. So that's the whole of the breath. And you don't say, okay, that's what I'm going to do now. It doesn't work. It just happens naturally as you get more interested in the breath. 100 different, 1,000 different experiences when you're watching your breathing. Just the same when you're doing walking meditation. You're walking on the red carpet there, and as you move your leg up, you see this, the whole body of one step as it moves up. What part of your foot leaves the carpet first? What leaves last? It doesn't always have to be the same part of your foot. Could be walking another way. But you notice as it moves up, what does it feel like? What muscles have to stretch or relax to actually to move a foot up? And just you can feel the muscles in the thigh and the tendons in the knee as your leg moves up, as you transfer your weight. It's not just the feet move, the legs and the body has to move as well. And then you move forward. And I asked myself, when my foot moves forward, does it like up, horizontal and down? Or does it move up and back a bit, and then up and over, and then down? What part of your foot touches the ground first? What last? What does it feel like? That is a similar to this third part of mindfulness of breathing. You're fully aware of just one foot moving. And then when you get to that, it gets really peaceful, really interesting. Dancers have to do that all the time, to actually to understand what muscles move when they're actually just doing an intricate sort of movement. But you're doing that, just moving, walking meditation. And you get amazed that when you're mindful, focus, hindrances have been restrained. Just how amazing that is, just to walk. Hundreds, thousands of different movements, and you're there watching all of them. It's really cool. And then you calm the breath as you breathe in and out. It gets very peaceful. It does it, you don't do it as a will, it just happens. So your breath gets very smooth and peaceful. Just like when you're walking. Just naturally you tend to walk more slowly because there's just too much going on to rush it. You just really get very cool and very peaceful. And that's very nice. So just as a skilled painter is aware whether they're making a long brush or a stroke or a short brush stroke, hey, wasn't the simile as a skilled lathe operator knows doing a long turn or a short turn. How many of you have used a lathe? Short turn, long turn. Not an electric one, the old-fashioned ones with a piece of bamboo. We had one of those. I used to use one of those, so I know exactly. I can understand the simile. But it's just so old. So, but many of you have done some painting. You know, you've done a long brush stroke or a short brush stroke. That's all. As a skilled painter is aware whether they're making a long brush stroke or a short brush stroke, so too when the in-breath is long, you're aware it is long. In this way, you're aware of your own body, you're aware that other bodies are the same as yours, you're abide aware of the nature of both your own and other bodies. What's that got to do with the breath? Because the breath is just another body. Your breath, other people's bodies, our breaths. Or else you abide aware what causes the arising of the body, which is the four nutriments. We come across, I'll do that tomorrow. You abide, or even this evening, I don't know. Abide aware that the body will cease when the four nutriments cease. You abide contemplating the body's cause or nature of both arising or ceasing. Or else mindfulness is just a body of that sort, it's just breath. Impermanent suffering, not me, not mine, not a permanent essence, is established in you to the extent necessary for mindfulness and wisdom, essential for liberation, and you will abide independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That is one way that you are mindful of the body, because I am now mindful of time, and I've gone over time and got a little meeting going to happen in a few minutes, but I'm sure that people are here, two of the people who are already here, so I don't think they will mind too much. So that is part of the Satipatthana. Have I totally bamboozled you? Bamboozled is one of my favourite words. It comes from bamboo. I don't think so. It means, ooh, what's going on? But little by little, you hear these things again and again and again. And you have these things, you can take a copy of this back with you if you wish. And you got the recordings to go with them, and you can listen to them, and it gets really interesting how this whole thing works. Da 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 da.
Oops. Sadhu. 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 Sadhu.